Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and how we are moving into a more open, more aware, more, I would say, spiritual society. But part of that is understanding psychology and how psychology and spirit really come together. So the last few shows have been dedicated to an organization I'm a part of, called the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. And tonight I have two more guests that are members of that organization. And the first guest is Celeste Mattingly. Welcome, Celeste.
Thank you, Alan.
You know, I do really like your approach because you deal with the hardcore psychological issues, and yet you also bring that spiritual awareness to the practice. Now, was that always the case with you, or were you strictly just someone dealing with psychology? How did it start for you?
Well, it actually started for me kind of in reverse, because I believe that I started out as a student of metaphysics, and because I started out as a student of metaphysics and consciousness raising, I always believed in spirituality. So I came into the field of social work knowing that somehow I was going to have to do this to integrate the two. So I remember being in social work school. I'm a late bloomer. I didn't start my MSW program until I was in my early 40s. And so I remember saying to some of my colleagues and classmates that we would have to get together and start a new theory for bringing spirituality and psychotherapy or psychology together. And so it's been a long road, but, you know, I feel like I'm starting to make a little headway, and I just was very impressed with the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. I found them accidentally one night when I was Googling for some information to write about, and there they were, so I became a member.
Well, it's great because we are building the organization. We want more people to become aware of the fact that, you know, that the two are so intertwined, the psychology and your spiritual understanding. But there is also, maybe there isn't a separation, but sometimes it seems like there is. I mean, people can suffer psychological conditions, like you say on your website, due to trauma or even chemical imbalance. Does that still for you have a spiritual component?
Well, it does in a very broad metaphysical way, because, you know, all energy is, I mean, all matter is really energy. So whether we're having a physical illness or whether it's a a brain chemistry imbalance, it really has to be addressed equally, I believe, you know, with a spiritual approach. So I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No. I mean, I sort of, as you were talking, I sort of realized, even if there was some kind of mood or chemical approach, like what level of the soul or spiritual development manifested those kinds of disorders to learn a lesson of the human experience. So in a sense, you can say it's spiritual that way, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Just like, I'm sure everyone's familiar with Louise Hay's work. She was the first one to really bring to mainstream metaphysical causes for physical illnesses and to use affirmations to help us heal ourselves. And so, you know, I think that that's the kind of approach that has to be taken with psychology as well.
Right. So when someone comes into your, like, do you have a particular orientation towards your spiritual beliefs or, you know, yeah, tell me.
I let them lead the way. You know, I do a conventional assessment that's 14 pages of paperwork, you know, lots of questions, and, you know, I make a professional diagnostic evaluation And then, one, of course, the questions that I do ask are, you know, what is your spiritual or religious orientation? Do you consider yourself a spiritual person or a religious person? I want to know what denomination they were raised in, whether they're currently practicing or not, and then we take it from there. Most of the folks that do find me on the internet admit that, you know, they are drawn to me because of my spiritual approach. So generally I have that awareness already. They'll say to me on the phone, you know, I loved what I read, and I really resonate with spiritual aspect of myself and life, and I want to come in and talk about that stuff. So,
well, I think if they do resonate with that, they already have some kind of basic handle, perhaps, mm-hmm. on some of the mental disorders, you might call them, that mm-hmm. may, like you, that you list, you know, like a depression. You know, if you're coming from a spiritual approach as opposed to some existential nihilist approach, you have some kind of awareness that there's something more, right?
Right.
So how do you work with people? I mean, I guess every case is different, of course, but what would you do if someone came to you with some kind of, even though they were depressed and you mm-hmm. know, they didn't seem to have any direction mm-hmm. or, I mean, is there any particular approach you would take?
Well, the first thing we, of course, I give them what I call, I give them a couple of tests, but the one that I use the most is the Beck's Depression Inventory. And if someone scores higher than 18 on that quiz, we talk about whether or not they would want to consider some kind of medication. And most of the people that do come to see me are either on something already, or they want to get off it, or they are wanting to get some help without conventional psychiatric medication. So we talk about a nutritional approach. I always recommend a multivitamin, a B complex, and of course now vitamin D, and the omegas. And then depending on whether they have a history of bipolar disorder or not, I would recommend that they look up the amino acid CME. And that has had some wonderful results for people that have, you know, just low-grade kind of a chronic depression that SAMe is really very good for. So then we start talking about, you know, what they believe about life and spirituality and what their relationships are. Nine times out of ten, we end up focusing on assertiveness, because in order to have good, positive interpersonal relationships, we really need to be able to say what's on our mind. We be assertively and not passively or aggressively. So assertiveness becomes a very primary focus of working with relationships. And of course, that inadvertently clears the fifth chakra, and sometimes if somebody's introduced to chakra work already, we can talk about that, and I can show them the exercises in my celestial psychology workbook and lead them on that path to have them do some exercises and homework, or come to a class and, you know, do some active participation that way.
So, I mean, I'm looking at your website. You have bipolar disorder, but you also have anxiety disorders that you work. Now, isn't there a difference? I think Freud even talked about the difference between psychosis and neurosis. So, I mean, would you say, and I don't really know, is bipolar order seems to be more of a psychosis as opposed to anxiety, which is more, you know, a lot of people have that kind of, I mean, it's not healthy.
Yeah, bipolar disorder and major depressive disorder can have qualities of psychosis, of, psychotic episodes can be thrown in between a major depressive episode or a bipolar mania can have psychotic features where somebody's really paranoid or having very little clarity and but basically, you know, we don't use the term neurosis anymore. And
we don't? Is that out of fashion?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. What did they use instead of that? I guess.
Well, you know, it just kind of, I don't really know how to describe it. It just kind of fell by the wayside, and all the other diagnoses just kind of, I don't think it ever really was a formal diagnosis, but.
Well, it's not a diagnosis, but it's more like the average person might have.
Yeah, the average person. And we all have, you know, varying degrees of all of the different diagnoses. I'm sure that's why when students are in school, we get medical student syndrome, whereas we're getting in depth with each of the different categories we end up thinking, oh, I have this or I have that, but we all just have touches of it, you know.
But isn't a psychotic break, one where a person really loses touch with the, let's say, consensus reality, you know, that's what, right.
Uh-huh, right. And I'm glad we're talking about this because it, you know, it segues into the transpersonal psychologies, because it was Stanislav Grof and Assagioli who really started to acknowledge that psychotic episodes and spiritual emergencies or spiritual crises really resemble each other, and that we really, as clinicians, have to understand whether or not somebody, you know, needs medication and hospitalization, or whether they're just having a psychotic episode or break as a result of the spiritual emergence that's happening in their lives. And that usually comes about because the individual has been doing a lot of deep meditation or Kundalini work. They're very involved in maybe hallucinogenics, and they just totally lose touch with reality. So it's really important.
Or do they get in touch with a greater reality? I mean, I think that's the issue, right, of spiritual emergence. It's like what may look like psychosis to someone who doesn't have a spiritual background is really an expansion of what's possible to someone who's having a spiritual emergence.
That's right. That's right.
And go ahead.
I really liked what Karen Herrick said last week on your show when she talked about this, and she said that we really have to be able to identify or that we can tell when somebody is psychotic or not, because they have been relatively neurosis-free, to use that term, or relatively sane for, you know, most of their lives or whatever, and then they have this sudden episode where they're, you know, having a... Well, and now in spiritual terms, a lot of folks are calling this a download. I'm sure you're
I get them all. Yes, a download.
Talking about this a lot. Yeah.
For some people, though, I mean, we've been in the spiritual, let's say, movement or something, but some people sort of have an overnight awakening.
Yeah.
And that's a real spiritual emergence where they don't know themselves if it's a psychotic episode or an awakening of some sort.
That's right. That's right. And so when they come into our offices, we really need to be trained to be able to tell the difference and to be able to help them appropriately. And this is why I really resonate with the association, because we really need to educate the public and educate our peers. You know, I just did a National Association Social Work Connecticut chapter conference, and I was a speaker for the title of my project was, Navigating the DSM-5, the Medical Model, and the New Age Spirituality, and, you know, to be able to, you know, not be afraid. Too many clinicians are afraid to be seen as woo-woo, and when we talk about this, these kinds of spiritual things that nobody want, like what Karen was talking about last week, where nobody really wants to talk about whether or not, you know, somebody is hearing voices because they're having a psychotic episode or because they are really opening up their consciousness and experiencing intuition and channeling, for instance, or, you know, becoming a medium. We need to understand these things. And so that was the focus of my talk, and it was well received. So hopefully.
Well, I think it's a very important topic. And I think the one other element we have to consider is that within the cultural context, mm-hmm. that it puts restrictions on what's possible. Mm-hmm. You can hear voices and be sane within that context, within that worldview. But right. in the worldview that we're developing with ASP and, of course, this program and lots of other people, I mean, I've seen perfectly normal channel people who hear voices or speak in tongues. And they are very functional people. I mean, sort of is what Karen was saying. If they live a normal life except for their channeling right. a 35,000-year-old warrior from Atlantis. Right. But besides that, most of their life is normal.
That's
what only makes that seem ridiculous is the restrictions we place on who we think we are.
That's right. Yeah.
So I think your work, I mean, if you choose to do it, and other people in ASP, is to change the paradigm that we're functioning in, so other people don't have to be called psychotic if they're having a spiritual emergence.
That's right.
So what do we do about that, though? How do we make those types of awakenings for a culture?
We come on Alan's show.
Well, thanks. Oh, sure.
Thank you for making these contributions. Yeah.
But what else would you do? I mean, what else it can be done? I mean, I know this is sort of outside your work maybe, but how can we make a difference, you know, is it just one by one people standing up and saying, you know what, there is a difference between a spiritual emergence and a psychotic breakdown?
Well, that would help, I think, Alan, as a species, we're all becoming, because, you know, we're evolving, and as a species, we're all becoming more intuitive and more aware of these things that, you know, and as we kind of get in touch with the noosphere, and just, it's all going to fall into place for everyone anyway, that this is, of course, I'm probably looking way too far ahead in the future.
No, say it. Go
yeah.
ahead. This is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we're all becoming more intuitive, and I think that as practitioners, we have to be not only work on our own consciousness to raise it on a daily basis so that we can keep up, but also to help our clients and, you know, the general public to recognize that, you know, these things are taking place. We're evolving into a species that is, you know, becoming more psychic, more telepathic. We're, you know, pretty soon telekinesis and these kinds of things that have been considered woo-woo and out of mainstream are becoming more and more mainstream, you know?
Yeah. So what do you do personally, if you don't mind sharing, to kind of stay in touch and understand your connection?
Well, lately I've been working with the sacred names for the Hurtat, from the Hurtat.
Oh, what does that do for you? Sacred Hebrew names of God, I guess there are. But what does that do for you?
It just warm fuzzy.
Okay.
And then I try to practice a little Tai Chi and balancing on a regular basis. And I, of course, I do making contact, and an evening, giving thanks at night and praise and stuff. Just kind of free form, quiet time. Yeah.
So do you see it changing? Do you see, like, the people that you're seeing every week, are they becoming more open?
Oh, yes, yes. And I have a couple of case studies that I'll be working up and writing to put into my next book, which is going to be the guidebook, which is actually going to be a textbook for psychotherapists, healing facilitators, and conscious evolutionaries. That's the third book of the trilogy that I'm working on. And so then that will have some case studies in it of where, especially there's one client that I worked with who just took to Eckhart Tolle's work like a fish out of water. Very intelligent man, had been a lawyer and was just having a relationship issue with his wife where they just couldn't get through one small, very high functioning, and he just blossomed with the concept of the ego, the egoic mind, as Eckhart Tolle brought it out in his book. And
it just made sense to him. It's like, boom, he suddenly had a way of defining his own consciousness in terms of the observer,
right,
and the neediness, I guess, the neediness of the ego.
And it gave him the power to make decisions in every moment, like, okay, I'm not going to say this to her. I don't want the ego, my ego, or the ego to have the upper hand here. I'm choosing to come from essence and love. And it was just beautiful the way that they repaired their relationship. And, I met her. She only came in twice. But he only came in for 10 visits, and that was it,
Well, I think that's the spiritual perspective, is that you have a choice in how you're going to act towards someone. I mean, if someone makes you angry, you could strike out, or you can say, I'm going to sit with this see how it feels and be the observer of this.
That's right. So do we have 3 or 4 minutes left?
Yes, go ahead.
Read to you and the readers the poem I wrote for chapter 4. It's chapter 4 is Loving Fear and Fearing Love, the Ego Story. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a poem based on the teachings of A Course in Miracles and Eckhart Tolle. And it's all about the ego. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, okay. Please. That's great. And also, could you send it to me after? We'll put this on the website, too, if you want.
Oh, great. Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Yes.
The ego's non-existent existence. Once upon a sacred time, when there was no time, when there was only love, and once upon a sacred space, where there was no space, where there was only oneness, where there was only sacred, timeless, spaceless no-thingness, there suddenly arose a tiny mad idea that we might like to separate from oneness. We took this tiny mad idea seriously, and with a big bang, we found ourselves in the center of the universe, surrounded by the sun, the moon, the stars, and a tiny, helpless physical form. We became increasingly afraid, ashamed, guilt-ridden, forgetful, and we fell into a deep, dreaming sleep. In our frightening nightmare, we believe that we are separate from our source, the sacred, timeless, spaceless no-thingness. In our frightening nightmare, we believe the voice of the egoic mind, which lulls us with its untruths. Stay asleep, O separated sonship. There is no salvation for you. You are damned to misery, suffering, limitation, lack, and oh, don't forget death. This voice sounded and continues to sound so real to us that we began to and we continue to defend it, believe in it, and buy into the belief that we need to love fear and be afraid of love. So real is this nightmare to us that we continue to construct universe upon universe out of it. We move further and further into our materialistic and dualistic nature until the pain gets so great we have to pause a moment, take a deep breath, and be still. It is here in the depths of a quiet pause where we discover the still small space that exists within each and every one of us, where we start to hear a different voice, a soft and loving voice, waking us from our nightmare, whispering, "Wake up, my child. It's only a bad dream. You can choose love, for that is what you are."
Thank you. I mean, it's interesting that when the ego's voice is talk, I like it because it's all of us. It's all of our predicaments.
But
I want to ask you about what you wrote there in the sense of if the ego's voice is talking to something, what is the ego's? We're observing the voice of the ego talking to our God, in a sense, our eternal being. So,
our essence, yes.
I mean, would you say that? I mean, the ego's voice will talk, and if we can just listen to it without identifying it, then we realize that, I mean, what I got from your poem, that we're the listener, not the talker, you know? We're not the ego. We're listening to the ego, so we can't be the ego if we're listening to it. You know what I mean?
That's right. And that's what A Course in Miracles and Buddhism teach us, you know, and Eckhart Tolle. That we don't want to listen to that. We want to identify with our essential selves or higher selves or our divine being.
Well, it's like listening to the radio. Like listening, it's like, you know, that's what they call the internal monologue that goes through our mind. That really is our programming. But if we identify with the observer, then we know we're essence. I mean, I'm saying it's not that easy, but, you know, it's like it's a huge shift. And, I think it's great that your work is taking people in that direction.
Yep. And, you know, I work a lot with addicts and alcoholics, and it's really a crucial point that to recognize that the voice of the monkey on our backs is, you know, the egoic mind, and there is a voice there, you know.
Right. And there's a listener there, too. You know,
yes. Yes. And that we want to identify with, you know, once we recognize that it's separate, that it's not me saying, eat that extra piece of chocolate, you know. Or I don't know about that, but, you know.
Right. It's not
certainly
you. Come on.
Like it's me, you know.
Right. It sounds like you, but it's not you.
Yeah. Making the choice, you know, right. We have a choice, and we need to be able to recognize that whenever we say, F it, you know, I'm going to choose negatively or think negatively or act out, you know, we are definitely moving away from our essential selves and away from, you know, a divine quality of life. So,
thank you, Celeste, for spending some time here. Any final words, and how can people reach you?
I can be reached at area code 860-586-8700. You can leave a message there. You can email me at cmattingly100@comcast.net. And, of course, you can look up my websites at CelesteMattinglyLCSW.com or CelestialPsychology.com.
Thanks. I hope to see you soon,
Thank
Celeste.
You, and hope to have you come to Connecticut and present at our Center for Holistic Empowerment.
Yeah. No, I would love to present there. Thank you. Let's be in touch, and I'll let you know when this is posted.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. I have some other questions I want to talk to you about, too, about like what I've seen on your website. So maybe we'll do another one sometime, okay?
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon. Bye. Okay. That was Celeste Mattingly, and my next guest along the same themes, although we'll be talking about spirituality, psychotherapy, and art, and how that all works together. So my next guest is Patricia Quinn. Are you on the line, Patricia?
Oh, hi, Alan. Yes, I'm right here.
Okay. Did you hear any of that last conversation?
I didn't. I'm sorry. Oh.
That's okay. No, that's okay. It's no good. Anyway, I think we should just jump into what you're doing because I like your approach using art as a form of therapy. Can you talk about that in terms of your work?
Yes. I became an art therapist in 1989. And so I've been working for almost 25 years. And it's, you know, I have to say that even coming to the field was kind of a soulful process because I had always been interested in art. But when I heard about art therapy, I'd gone all the way through college and then some, and I never really known about it. But as soon as I read one book, I was just drawn to it. It was kind of like I found something that I liked even more than art, and that was that approach of making art from an authentic place. And so it really helped me to kind of recondition myself and to understand a little bit more how to make the kind of art I always wanted to make by not, feeling like I had to fit into some other school of art, but to come from within.
But were and you an artist really... before this, or were you doing
I
therapy
was.
Before?
Well, as a matter of fact, I came to art therapy because I had to leave an MFA program where I had a complete scholarship and a teaching job because, it was just kind of one of these Saturn returns where I was just thrown into such a tizzy with what I found at the school. Some really unfortunate events just unfolded. Nobody's fault. It was just people being who they were, and I realized that it wasn't for me, and after about a month, I left and learned about art therapy really from my own therapist, and so it was one of those situations where you're kind of snatched from the jaws of disaster by some wonderful change, and I'm just so glad that. I've seen so many other people have a similar kind of grasp of insight because the art opens up the non-dominant parts of the brain, the parts of the brain that we don't usually use. So for a lot of people, it's the right brain because we're in a very analytical left brain world. And it just sets all these different processes in motion.
So if someone comes to you and they have some kind of, situation, they're depressed or their relationship or their something's bothering them or You would have them draw, talk about how you work in that way and what, you know.
Well, I've had a private practice for about 15 years up here in Warwick and that area of Orange County. And I've also worked in addiction treatment mostly for the past 23 years. So I'm used to people coming to me who have no interest in art, no prior background in art, and many people are really kind of intimidated by the art. So I don't necessarily push the art. My first goal is just to try and make people feel comfortable, you know, establish a rapport. And but I know in the back of my mind that if there's something that's unclear or something that they can't verbalize often, that I have this tool, art as well as hypnosis, because I'm certified in Ericksonian hypnotherapy and NLP as well, because they both have a ability to bring a person into the moment. You know, when you're making art, you're not able to really think so much about the past and the future. You're very concerned about what your hands are doing and, you know, how you want to move this material around and organize it. And then you're kind of curious about how it's looking and what this art therapist is going to think of you. So you're right in the moment, and it doesn't really allow you to so much be in the ego state of, you know, being very defended and, you know, creating this whole story about, you know, what you're about or what you think.
So when we're not in the ego state, you're saying the, let's say, the repressed aspects of a situation can start to rise up from the part that's been buried and it manifests in the work? Does that happen?
Yeah, exactly. What happens, and now everybody's a neuroscientist, so I'm a neuroscientist. You know, I have this neuroscience that explains what all the art therapists have been seeing for so long. But what they found out is happening is that the act of making art is a sensory stimulation. You know, even if somebody hasn't got sight, they can still, you know, have the feel of the material. Same thing for music, you know, the vibration of drums and things like that. It all stimulates the sensory apparatus, and that activates the haptic sensory brain, which is just the opposite of addiction. It's, you know, when people are trapped in addictions, you know, we're doing the same thing over and over to feel comfortable. But when we're in that creative flow, you don't know what's going to happen next, really. You think you have an idea of how you want it to go, but there's a lot of spontaneity about it. So that all activates the thalamus, and that activates the amygdala, which has been sometimes shut down by trauma. And then that releases sometimes more of a fully formed memory that can then reach the hippocampus and be understood and also stored away for future reference. So this is how it's, you know, art therapy, art in general.
I love all that. Where can I read more about that whole process?
But one of my favorite is an article by Via Lusebrink in the 2004 Journal of the American Art Therapy Association. Wonderful article about that in particular, and a lot
Wait, what's
more.
What's her name? What's the person's name?
It's Vija Lusebrink. Lusebrink, and she's
right.
Worked a lot with neuroscientists and I believe she has a PhD in art therapy and something else, maybe psychology. But also now there is a neuroscience art therapy graduate program at the Phillips Institute in California, I think near Los Angeles, that is run by another wonderful art therapist, psychologist, neuroscientist, who I'll think of her name in a minute, but okay. she has a wonderful book on neuroscience and art therapy.
Do you know the name of that book? I just think it's really fascinating that the creative aspect of ourselves can call up things that are beyond our conscious awareness.
Oh, absolutely. So you were saying, you know, when somebody comes to me, so they may, indicate that they have some kind of a phobia or something going on. Art therapy and neuroscience is Noah Haas Cohen, HASS-COHEN, and Richard Carr, CARR. Okay. So anyway, there may have to be kind of sold on the idea of doing some art, so I might ask him to draw with their non-dominant hand.
Mm-hmm.
To get
right. Oh, right. Drawing from the left side, the right side of the brain, that's a great book. I know. Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, this is different. That's more
Betty
Edwards.
That's
more art. This is more more like Lucia Capaccioni. She wrote about journaling with the non-dominant hand. Because it really connects with the soul. It connects with information that is out of time and, in the collective unconscious. It's right there. And
I guess that's what Jill Bolte Taylor experienced in that TED Talk, you saw that, right, where she's totally left brain.
Yeah, I read her book, and it is so beautiful how she said that in that state, she got the get well cards, and she could feel the love in those get well cards. They were plastered all over her walls, and that was part of what helped her get better.
But also that I think it's great. But also what you're saying is what I'm writing about as far as the artists are the ones in general, not just art therapy, but are tapping to other realms of reality because they are using that parts of the brain that are sensing more outside the restricted culture that we've been brought up in. So
it's absolutely amazing. It's more than that even. The art is nurturing. So it activates the mirror neurons. They're sort of at the base of the brain. I think they must be near the cerebellum. That's how we learn. That's how we form attachment. That's what makes children imitate sounds, words, to pick up all kinds of things like facial expression and understand social cues. A lot of people are walking around, Alan, who do not have that. That was not developed in them. There was nobody there. They were not really nurtured, and they can start to learn to get these. This is actually really hardcore neuroscience. There's a guy, Shore, S-H-O-R-E, who's written quite a bit about how Shore, Kaplan, and Menzin are talking about how the creative work through the symbol allows this information to come through. It's somewhat coded, but it will awaken people's ability to think and see things symbolically.
And to feel, you're saying. Their ability
and
to feel. Yeah.
Exactly. Because it's all happening in the limbic system, and the limbic system is the connection between the mind, body, and emotion and spirituality. Because when this person who's sitting in front of me says they don't really feel like doing anything, and then they draw something with the left hand, and this really happened. I saw the only thing I could make out of this abstract two-second drawing they did was like a baseball diamond, mm-hmm. and that turned out to be the symbol that unlocked a whole trauma that was so subtle that they didn't realize that's what was really driving a really neurotic habitual pattern that was going to destroy them. And it was a young person who, you could just see the light go on in her eyes. She went from being indifferent and suspicious within 5 minutes to realizing that she, within a minute even, to realizing that she had just helped to heal herself. She, there was something inside of her that could get released through the art that was going to participate in her healing.
That was and because she made that connection, she freed up the repressed energies, in a sense. Right?
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Right.
You know, I'm really fascinated with that because I do think artists have the key to the future as well. I mean, yes, it's good for the repressed areas of ourselves, but I think they're also the engines of evolution. I think, and this is what I'm writing about, the artist creates new realities by sensing an awareness that has been shut down to everyone else, but because they stimulate this greater part of their own spirit connection, they seek bigger, a greater reality, and they bring that into cognition.
It's absolutely radical, and that's why I think more people need to tap into their creativity. So that
I think everyone does. I think it's the currency of the future is their creative action.
It has to be, because otherwise we're just going to believe everything that the boob tube is telling us, you know, which is pretty much, you know, just whatever the mainstream media wants us to believe. But if you are doing art, you're going to wake up your mind. You're going to free your mind. That's the name of my website, is artfreesyourmind.com, because it does. It opens up all of these pathways. Plus, if somebody has like a brain injury or preverbal trauma or something, this is another pathway to knowing, you know, something and to being able to express it. If you have autism,
right. I think that's a great way. Art is a path to knowing, even though it's been so ridiculed by the mainstream, who thinks you have to know things with your intellect.
Exactly. And there's a beautiful book about that by Pat Allen, who she's a Dr. Pat Allen, who I think teaches out out West. She's an amazing art therapist, and she's kind of led the movement of art studios, open art studios that encourage people to just come in and make art in community. It's in storefronts and things. But she has a book called Art is a Way of Knowing, and it's just a beautiful book. It just takes just the right tone.
Right. You know, there's that book by Raymond Williams. Do you know him? The Long Revolution he wrote.
No, I don't.
He says the long revolution is the revolution of perception that the artist makes for the rest of the culture.
Uh-huh. Well, that's always been the case.
Yeah.
You know, people look at Guernica, you know, and that painting was so powerful, they'd still not allowed back into Spain.
Really? It's still, isn't that amazing?
It's a powerful, powerful piece of artwork, and you know, just so many amazing, enduring, even some of the art that's hanging on our refrigerators, you know, it just really brings up all the oxytocin in your body, you know, and it just changes your whole being. You know, it's very powerful.
Right. I should read you this quote from, because I think he makes such a great point in this book, The Long Revolution, which is not so much about art therapy, but it's about how we have to change and how the only way we can change really is through art and this level of perception, you know.
Oh, so that sounds wonderful.
I think I don't know if I can find this quote, but tell me then, so when someone comes into your office and you're doing therapy, but then is it your last resort, art therapy, or is it your first resort?
Well, it's just there. I mean, I can certainly just talk to people. Some people I do a lot of listening with, a little bit of talking with. But art is always there, as I said, as a tool. Yeah, I'm also an energetic healer, so I have those things that I can also offer. But so it's just nice to have other... I think, you know, art is one of the experiential therapies. I think that's the best description of it. And so it gets out of that verbal mode, which sometimes we just put ourselves right into a trance with all of the ways that we talk about our experiences. And there's, you know, I love to hear the stories, and stories are so important, but sometimes... you know, when the story is serving us to bring it into another medium, reframes it in a whole different way, and again brings in that soul aspect, which, you know, many neuroscientists are starting to see that, you know, the left brain is very ego-driven and the right brain is something entirely different. And the way that you see people revealing what is going to help them. Sometimes a lot of people will just depict nature. You know, they sit down to draw, and it'll be a beautiful scene or a branch of a tree. And through that act, they realize that they're not getting into nature enough. So it's like the unconscious soul healer is coming through and saying, you know, this is, you're neglecting something that you really love and you really need.
So is the right brain, you think, our connection to the divine? I mean, that's how I saw it. I say it's like, you know, we have this internet in our brain that we didn't even know we had to the connection. Right. And then the creative action, as like William Blake says, is the action of the divine.
Well, there seems to be something going on in the prefrontal cortex, in the areas, the striatal accumbens, and these areas of the brain where there's some very interesting chemical exchanges that happen and that can lead to this kind of enlightenment. And, you know, you have to be relaxed and you have to be... you know, kind of centered, and there are a lot of different ways to do that, like Tai Chi. Again, it's movement, it's sensory, there's a certain reverence for it. But the neat thing about art is that it's actually going to reflect back the language that we're actually the most familiar with. We're constantly bombarded by imagery. And like you said, we've been all raised to think that the real intellect is the verbal written intellect. But think about it, how much of our day is spent just receiving and coding and filing away all these images and with different feelings. We're doing that all day long. And art is just turning the tables and allowing that process to come out, like, run the movie, project it out, see what's in there.
Right. Do you see a moment in when you're looking at people's art where, you know, a lot of the art that comes out in art therapy is sort of like scribbling. It's a release of frustration. And then can you see a moment of transcendence in that art where they get beyond the egoic repressions and something really pure comes through. Do you ever see that?
Every single time. I don't always understand it, and I'll give you a quick example. One gentleman was just really angry, and I just encouraged him to get the energy out, because that's another thing. You can just, it's another form of expression. Instead of breaking a window, it's creative, it's expressive, may not look like anything. He covered the paper with dark blue crayon. Covered the paper with indigo. He was pissed. He had just found that he was, you know, he was not too happy about some people who were making plans about his future.
Right.
When I held the paper up to him to ask what he saw, immediately the light went off. Immediately, because he had had that sensory stimulation, he said, "Oh my God, it's the nighttime. The nighttime. That's what has always been my problem." And it went back to something childhood. We didn't even go there, but we identified something. And he was close to 50 years old, and he had suffered a lot of confinement in his life. And now he was actually set free. He knew that there was a reason why he could not stay inside at night and would go out and get in trouble. Yeah, get in trouble, get locked up over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And what a nice person he was. And I have to tell you, too, that every time, I really miss working in addiction treatment, because I just retired 2 years ago, but it was so amazing. You know, people with addictions, they're some of the most spiritual people. You ask them to draw, like, what they're getting sober for, what they want. Mm-hmm. It's love. It's my children. It's, you know, peace, freedom. Mm-hmm. They're not drawing the TVs, the screens, the devices, the cars, very rarely. Right.
Well, let me ask you one question, because we're almost out of time. Is there a place where, you know, like, I mean, there's art everywhere. You know, you go to a museum. Is that all art therapy, or is there a moment where art transcends therapy and becomes a universal symbol for all? Like, the artist, in a sense, is a channel of something greater. Or is that still art therapy? I'm just trying to see, is there a distinction between the two?
I mean, I think, you know, it's like saying, is there spirituality or science? Everything is spirituality. Everything is science. Everything is therapy. Everything is art, really.
I see. But there are some things, there's some art, like that guy with the blue crayon, well, that might relate to other people, but there's some art, like, everyone just gets, oh my God, they could connect with it. And in a sense, that transcends the personal and speaks to the impersonal, maybe, or the transpersonal. Maybe all art does that if we look at it.
I think it all does. It really, because it's coming from that place that is not just egoic. I mean, we need both sides of the brain. We need everything. But, you know, so we see the culture. I like to go to the Metropolitan Museum and go into some of the ancient wings and do the strong eye technique and just stand in front of some of these statues and images and see the energy coming out and feeling it. It's all, there's a lot of energy that's encoded and that can be released when we fathom the art.
Patricia, we have to wrap up. Thank you. What's your website again?
It's artfreezeyourmind.com.
Artfreezeyourmind.com. Patricia Quinn, I'm sorry. Maybe we can do another conversation, because I think there's a lot more to get into with brain chemistry and understanding, awakening the deeper parts of ourselves. Thank you. I'll let you know when this is up on the ASP website. And any final words there?
I appreciate you're doing this, and you know, when you asked that question, I realized, you know, that some art, you know, may be done for the sake of art, but it is still it still carries, I think, a lot of soul material in it.
Okay. Thanks, Patricia. I'll talk to you.
Thank you, Alan. Okay. Bye-bye.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. Thanks for listening. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com, and listen next week. Thanks.